Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, John Clayton.
Hey, it's a great time of year. You've got football going on. It's August, good weather, and also a chance for people still to take some vacation time, but also to plan ahead. And one thing I think in the reading standpoint, here's something to plan ahead for. It's going to be available in November. The book is called Guts and Genius, the story of three unlikely coaches who came to dominate the National Football League in the 1980s. And I think everybody wants to read about Bill Walsh, Joe Gibbs, Bill Parcells. And so make the plans right now when this comes out in November to get Bob Glauber's book. And Bob Glauber joins us on Schooled with a Professor. And so, Bob, what got you into this book with getting three genius-type coaches in Bill Walsh, Joe Gibbs, and Bill Parcells?
Well, you know, John, I actually started covering football in the mid-80s, and it was a great time, not only to be a football fan, but to be a journalist. You got a chance to really get to see what goes on in the inner workings of teams. And I got to know Parcells quite well, having covered the Giants. And I just thought there was something, some connection with these three guys who collectively dominated that decade. And then, you know, Gibbs, of course, in the early 90s, won his last Super Bowl. And I just wanted to look back, what made these guys great, kind of look at their upbringings and what their influences were, and how it kind of related to today's game. And there is a connection that I didn't realize was so prevalent. When you look at when Walsh won his first Super Bowl, it was 1981. There have been 37 Super Bowls since that time. And of those 37, either Walsh, Gibbs, or Parcells won them, or their coaching descendants won them. 30 out of 37, including Doug Peterson, who was from the Walsh coaching tree, you know, not directly but indirectly. And I just found it fascinating that these guys still have an impact today, and the rivalries that happened back then, the players, the characters, Lawrence Taylor, Joe Theismann, Dexter Manley, you know, the coaches, Joe Montana, Jerry Rice. It just went on and on. There's so many stars, so many Hall of Fame talents, all playing in the same league at the same time, and it was really a special time. I loved going back and doing the research and interviewing Gibbs and Parcells and getting interviews about Walsh, who was absolutely a fascinating character.
Well, let's start with Bill Walsh, because I think everybody, particularly when he was in Cincinnati as an assistant coach, you know, thought he did have genius-type qualities. But there was just something about him that the Bengals weren't willing to really take a chance and let him become the head coach. And it was getting to the point where it didn't seem like anybody in the league, other than, say, San Francisco, was going to give him that chance. I mean, what was it about the good of him in Cincinnati that still people weren't buying into?
Yeah, I think the main guy that didn't buy into it, and maybe was a little threatened, maybe a lot threatened, was Paul Brown. Now, Paul Brown was a legend, you know, in Cleveland, and then he formed the Bengals as an expansion team. He was kind of a larger-than-life figure. And Paul Brown had an insecurity about him in that he did not like to give credit to a lot of the people around him. Now, doing the research on this and talking to people who were actually there and about it, including Craig Walsh, Bill Walsh's son, who was a ball boy back then. He had incredible insight into the dynamic there. You know, Bill was a Colt. He was a young, up and coming guy who had a lot of interesting ideas, and he helped Paul Brown in a big way. And Paul Brown didn't want that to kind of get out. Paul Brown wanted to take the credit for that offense that was very, you know, tight, small, short passes. You know, use the passing game to basically have a running game, because they had a quarterback named Virgil Carter who couldn't throw the ball more than 30 yards. So it was Walsh who figured out, well, we got to work at this guy's strengths, and there aren't many. But he's a smart guy, he's an accurate guy, so we'll go here. So a lot of people give Paul Brown the credit for being the forerunner of the West Coast offense, but that was really Bill Walsh's offense. And I think Paul Brown was threatened by it, didn't give Bill Walsh a chance to take over. He went with Tiger Johnson, the offensive line coach, much more traditional, kind of tough guy, runs the physical offense kind of thing. And Walsh didn't get his chance. I'll tell you, John, that profoundly impacted Bill Walsh, and it profoundly impacted the NFL, because when that happened, when Walsh was passed over, he promised himself he would never, ever do that to an assistant coach if he ever got a chance to be a head coach again. And then you saw the Bill Walsh coaching tree, which continues to grow today, it's a direct result of what had happened. It was a terrible time for him.
No question. And then the great part is how much he changed the game. Because, you know, I know covering it back in the 70s, I mean, you didn't have nickel defenses. You didn't have a passing type of game. It was more of a running game that was backed up by defense and hard hitting. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, here's Bill Walsh coming in, and the first thing he does is kind of put basketball shoes on everybody and have them all kind of run these exotic type of routes like you're running a basketball court, and people were scrambling to try to keep up with it.
Yeah, he was very much into spatial study of the game. I mean, he created space, and he did that in very unconventional ways for the time. Now everybody takes it for granted, the West Coast offense, you know, it's probably the predominant offense run in the NFL, but back then it was not run ever at all. It was just, you know, straight ahead, smash mouth. You know, you had the big passing game in certain spots, and Cincinnati was one of them, but you know, you had this new system coming on that Walsh had the vision to create, and like a lot of new ideas, John, it wasn't accepted at first, and I think people scoffed at it. Walsh felt people scoffed at it, and it bugged him. You know, he was a very insecure guy at heart, and he had a lot of doubts about that, but he did keep to that conviction and stuck with it. In San Francisco, you know, there were times when he thought he couldn't do this. In his second year, he was on a plane after a loss to Miami, and he broke down in tears. The coaches and executives had to kind of cover up just to make sure that the players didn't really see him crying. He was ready to quit, but he didn't, and it was a very big turning point for him. He just lost to Don Shula, who was part of that 70s dynasty with Shula and Chuck Knoll and John Madden and, you know, Tom Landry, and now this guy is having all these doubts, but he stuck with it, and that obviously helped him and helped the NFL, and here we are. Guy won 3 Super Bowls and led a lot of other coaches in that direction.
Well, and then the other thing, too, because I know Pete Carroll worked for him or was at least on the 49ers staff, so he's part of that tree. And,
sure,
you know, there was a uniqueness that Bill had as far as acquiring talent because, I mean, he wanted big veteran defensive linemen, you know, that could, you know, really kind of dominate at the line of scrimmage. He wanted pass rushers that would be a little bit different. And then, you know, first thing out of the box, he comes and even though he's a defensive an offensive coach, he drafted on defense in the secondary, and that started getting the 49ers, a team that was just terrible, turned around quickly.
He was a great personnel guy. You know, he had a share of misses like everybody, but he had a way of figuring out who was going to fit into his system. And I had long talks with John McVay, who was the 49ers general manager and really Bill Walsh's chief personnel guy, and they worked together for many, many years and were great for one another. Walsh was the outspoken alpha male in that room, and McVay was willing to do the dirty work there. And McVay would just tell me, Bill would show up at these workouts, even a workout where people off the street were invited. And he saw a guy one day, he said to McVay, who's that toe-headed guy out there? And it was a fullback. And McVay said, that's Billy Ring. He says, I like him, you know, sign him. And he just instantly he saw that Bill Ring could do some things in the Bill Walsh offense that contributed. And he was, he was one of those blue collar type fullback guys, and he would make some catches out of the backfield. But you know, Walsh had that ability to find talent. Even Jerry Rice, you know, Jerry Rice wasn't drafted high or as high as a lot of people might have thought, but Walsh saw him on a highlight show one day when he was in Houston getting ready for a game against the Oilers. And he said, oh, man, who is this guy? And he said, I got to get him. And he turned out to be the perfect fit for the West Coast offense and gave him that home run threat that he had really not had up until that time.
Now, what was it when he took Jerry Rice? Because, I mean, here's Rice, the greatest of all time. He's the GOAT, but didn't have good speed. And, mm-hmm. you know, Bill Walsh said, no, this is the guy. You got to get him. And look what a great career he had and what it really involved.
Right, right. And, you know, I think Rice was a 4.6 in the 40, and there was a lot of doubts about him. And, you know, a lot of people did pass on him as a result. And he played not at a huge school in Mississippi, but it was, you know, there were some questions about him, some questions about his hands, and he had some problems early on with drops early in his career with San Francisco. But I had a chance to talk to Jerry, and I'm telling you, Jerry Rice considers Bill Walsh as the single biggest reason for the greatness of his career. and just the way he prepared him, the way he taught him, and the way he believed in him. You know, when Rice would drop passes, Walsh would come over and kind of put an arm around him and say, don't worry about it, just do what you do, I believe in you. And then there was a time when Rice caught, like, I think it was 3 touchdown passes against the Rams, and Walsh called him up to his office. And this was very early in his career, maybe his first year, and Walsh called him up. And Rice was like, coach is going to give me a pat on the back. This is great. So Walsh told him, I need you to do better than that. So I'm like, Rice is like, what? And he couldn't believe it. But that's the kind of guy Walsh was. He saw excellence. He demanded excellence. But he knew people and what they needed at that time. And he challenged the great players around him, including Montana, including Rice, to be even greater. And that was part of the uniqueness of him in being able to bring out the best in players, no matter what their talent level was.
Bill Walsh had the West Coast offense, but another offense that was really significant was the Don Coryell offense. And I still remember vividly, talking to Joe Gibbs when he was on the Chargers staff, about what is going on with this offense and what makes it so good. So he goes to the Redskins and gets 3 Super Bowls, and he did it at the most difficult time because he did it with all the labor-type problems that were there. Mm-hmm. What was so good about Joe Gibbs?
John, Joe Gibbs, you can argue, was the greatest offensive tactician ever. And, I guess you'd put Walsh in there as maybe 1 and 1A, but you got to put Gibbs in there because he won those 3 Super Bowls with 3 quarterbacks, none of whom was close to Hall of Fame caliber. And he did it through his system. He did it through guile. He did it through a grasp of the X's and O's that was really second to none. Jeff Bostic, the center, remembered a time in the Super Bowl against Denver. It was in the 87, after the 87 season. They did not start off well, and Gibbs kind of can't figure out what's going on. And the Broncos were doing something different. So Bostic was telling me that Gibbs kind of went over to him on the sideline. He said, what's going on? What's happening? And Bostic would explain that the Broncos were using kind of a 46 defense that they had not used ever, and they were a little confused by it. So Gibbs stands there, and he had this posture where he just kind of stand, fold his arms, put his finger on his cheek, and just think a moment. He thought for maybe 30 seconds, and he says, "All right, here's what we're going to do." And they basically went back to the bread and butter counter gap stuff that they had not been doing. And then Timmy Smith has this breakout game. Doug Williams has the game of a lifetime, is the Super Bowl MVP, and the rest is history. And Bostic said, "I've never seen in-game adjustments like that ever." And he to this day, he is astounded by it. And he thought back, it's like it's yesterday when he thinks back to this thing. And that kind of encapsulates what Joe Gibbs was about. He could respond to just about any given situation and come out on top. And I say just about because it was the Giants who had, he had a problem against. He just never seemed to be able to figure out consistently how to beat that team once they had Lawrence Taylor.
Of course, how can you stop Lawrence Taylor? Because, he was just unblockable. But, of course, the guy that created the ability to get Lawrence in the right spots was Bill Parcells, who probably commands a room better than just about any other coach I've been around. He commands a room, shows his authority and all that. What made Bill so special?
Well, John, you say he commands a room, and he could command any room, including the press room. And there are still times to this day where I think back and listen, and I can hear Bill Parcells talking in my ear, in the writer's ear. I look at fellas, and he just had this way about him that was so charismatic, and that transferred over to the players. Now, he had a problem his first year, and when we talk about the unlikely ascent of these coaches, all of them had, some questions about whether they were up to it, and Parcells that first year in 83, his team was 3-12-1. Both of his parents died during the season. His running backs coach died. His dog died, and that was a big deal. People say, your pet. Well, then any dog owner will know that that's a big deal. And it was just this horrendous run for Bill Parcells in his first year. He had 25 players on injured reserve, but he kind of reached down and said, "I got to be Bill Parcells again. I'm trying to be somebody I'm not." And Bill Parcells, at his core, at his essence, was a guy who believed in running the football, stopping the run, and using the guy like Lawrence Taylor and his defensive players to be very aggressive. And that 3-4 defense was not widely used back then, but he and then Bill Belichick, you know, helping him in a big way, figured out how to really stymie a lot of offenses by just being so imaginative and so talented and so quick that they were able to use the talents of those guys, you know, Taylor, Harry Carson, Leonard Marshall, Carl Banks, you know, you go on and on. That was a great personnel time for the New York Giants, and they had just great defenses and great talent. And Parcells just had this inimitable way of getting things out of players that they didn't think they could get out of themselves. And I think, you know, Gibbs and Walsh had that to a great degree too. Parcells had it in a very Jersey guy, in your face, listen, do it my way, or I'm going to, you know, you're out of here kind of way. And they responded. And those players, Phil Simms said it straight out, I wouldn't be who I am today if it weren't for Bill Parcells. And you could probably say that for just about every player who won a Super Bowl for Bill Parcells in 86 and in 90.
And that's the one thing with Bill. I mean, of course, it was, I mean, as great as it was with Lawrence Taylor, maybe the greatest defensive player in the history of the game, Lawrence was a handful to coach because, you know, he had so many off-the-field issues and was so tough. I mean, how did Bill control that? Because he clearly did.
Yeah. Well, he controlled it as much as he could, but Lawrence Taylor was basically uncontrollable. At, you know, at his core, he was this wild, crazy guy who, you know, partied like crazy, had a devastating drug problem. And Parcells did try to help him at several junctures. I think he gets a little annoyed that people think he just overlooked it and didn't try to help him, but he did. You know, Taylor tried and failed a number of times at rehab. But I think Parcells reached Taylor at a level that no one had ever done before with Lawrence Taylor. And that was, he recognized his greatness, but he also recognized his humanity and that the guy was basically this kid at heart who had tremendous problems. And they could relate at a level that Taylor never had in his life except for his father. And Parcells was the surrogate father for Lawrence Taylor. And that really helped him a lot as a man. And they, you know, they're still in contact today. They, you know, Parcells still has to help Lawrence Taylor every now and then because Lawrence still hasn't, you know, completely straightened out his life. But he's alive, and that, you know what, Lawrence Taylor himself at age 30, if he were to tell you, someone would ask him, you still be alive in, you know, 2018, he'd probably say no way. But, you know, somehow, some way he's still here. So Parcells had this special relationship with Taylor. Wasn't always perfect, but, you know, they had a mutual respect for one another that you really didn't see with a lot of star players and their coaches.
And then finally, just from the strategic standpoint, you know, because of the West Coast offense and all the moving parts, that got nickel defense into the game to try to match up against it with that spacing. You know, Bill Parcells with the 3-4, you know, imaginative. And then remember, what carried in the 80s, as you write, is basically what now is part of this game. I mean, how these guys changed everything, and this was, what, 80s?
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, John. I don't know that, you know, younger fans today would kind of understand that connection, but it's an important connection. You know, it's a continuum in the NFL, and it's a continuum in sports where things develop over time, things change, and they progress. But there was this incredible system that Bill Walsh put into place in the 80s, and it really has stood the test of time, and it continues today in the offshoots of what people do with the West Coast offense is directly attributable to him. And a lot of the ways to try to stop that West Coast offense can be attributed to Bill Parcells and Bill Belichick, who now, you know, has become maybe the greatest coach of all time, in part because of the lessons that he learned from Bill Parcells. It was a very unique relationship, very special. They had their differences over time, but, you know, Bill Belichick looks back very, very fondly at Bill Parcells and what he's done. So, you know, you get both sides of the ball, offense and defense, that kind of came into being in the 80s that in a lot of ways continues today. Now, where does Joe Gibbs stand here? Well, you know, Joe Gibbs didn't really have a great coaching tree. Most of his coaches, you know, who left him, you know, Joe Bugle or Dan Henning, they were not successful head coaches. It was Gibbs who was the brilliant orchestrator of that team, and that was pretty clear. a lot of the things you see from Gibbs are not in existence today. And, you know, John Madden, I quoted him pretty liberally in the book. He was terrific on his insight. But John Madden, he says, you know, teams should kind of maybe take a look at what Joe Gibbs did with that Mac Protect stuff and, you know, trying to get let your quarterback stay on his feet instead of just, you know, exposing them with these five receiver sets and four receiver sets, and he's got no chance. You got to get rid of the ball quickly. So, you know, the lessons of those guys from the 80s still apply today, and it's a pretty incredible thing to see.
Guts and Genius comes out in November, but you can get it now. Bob, how do we do that?
You can pre-order that on the usual places, Amazon, Walmart, anywhere else that sells books in pre-order. Really, really enjoyed it, and I hope people kind of get a sense of what it's like. I did get some good feedback from people who have checked it out, so I think it's, you know, when you look at football today and trace it back to that heyday and those glory days back in the 80s, it's kind of a cool thing.
Bob Glavers, thanks for joining us, and good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me, John. Really appreciate it.
And that does it for this week's podcast. In between episodes, you can follow me on Twitter at ClaytonESPN. If you enjoy these weekly one-on-one conversations, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Schooled with a Professor.